And good evening. How are we doing? I'm glad it's warm in here. don't really have anywhere I want to start. Let me take that back. I don't have an opening verse I want us to consider here, or a verse that's really going to theme the Bible study tonight. So just talk with you guys here for a minute, and then I'll get some of your guys' feedback. Yeah, really close to wrapping up this series, an encouraging series. Lots of good reminders to fulfill the purpose for which we've been raised into this army, and it is spiritual warfare, and so we're going to be fighting on behalf of spiritual things. So it's easy, because we are surrounded by the temporal, to lose sight sometimes. So I've really been encouraged and enjoyed the series. Next couple of bulletin backs that Jay had written are focused on goals. I like goals. I'm going to talk about goals. I don't think I'm going to spend 4 weeks on goals. So I'm going to condense this a little bit and kind of do my thing today. And your guys' involvement, participation, comments will kind of tell me where we need to go from there. And then really we only have a couple more classes after that. So we're looking at maybe end of January being done. So I wanted to start with a line here, one we know well. The Church of Jesus Christ is guaranteed victory. I was actually thinking about it this way today. trying to think about how to explain this. So one thing I had to change when I got married is I started locking the car in the house. So when I lived by myself, I was never really in a big habit of locking the house when I left. And I lived in a one-bedroom apartment. And I had a coffee maker that I didn't use. And that was my only kitchen appliance. Nope, I had a juicer that I also didn't use. and then I had a TV and a couch and my bed. So I kind of figured I don't have much, and so I don't need much. And if someone came and took my TV, then I probably just didn't need it. And then, guess what? We are so persecuted in this country that I could drive down to Walmart and get a new one if I really wanted it that bad. So, well, then I got married, and that had to change. Because I have more in the house now, don't I? I don't just have a TV and a coffee maker I don't use. I got a family. So I got thinking about when the thief comes in and steals. And so that got me thinking today. And so I asked the question first to myself, but what's the most precious thing that you own? And I don't mean like the blender and the juicer that you don't use. I mean, if you could personify yourself as a building, and obviously the spiritual things are weightier than the temporal things. I mean, what's the most valuable thing you possess? I think we would all agree it would be the salvation of our soul. And you know what's really nice about that? Nobody can take that. Now, I'm not saying leave your spiritual house open to intruders. Guard your mind and your heart. Be careful what goes in your ears and through your eyeballs. But just think about this for a moment. The most valuable thing that you have cannot be taken. So all that other stuff, does it matter? Well, not when you put it in the perspective of eternity. It doesn't, does it? Okay. The Church of Jesus Christ is guaranteed victory. So, no matter what elements are thrown your way, you know, we say, you know, are we battling the elements right now? I mean, I think I read somewhere by the time it's all said and done tonight, 50 below with wind chill. Yeah. And that's if you follow wind chill. I'm more of a just tell me how cold it is kind of guy. So 20-something below tonight, I mean, that's cold. We're battling the elements. And so when we battle the spiritual elements, Satan comes in, steals our TV. We come home, right? And the TV's gone. And so at first we're like, hey, that's not right. You know, you open up the car door and the wallet's gone. You're like, ha! You know, and once you get past the fact that somebody's been in your house and how they get in there in the first place, and you look on the shelf, right? And look what's still up on the shelf. That 3,000-year-old preserved Voss that's been in the family for 3,000 years. The salvation of your soul. Still there. Because it can't be taken. So once you get past the initial, you know, who would do such a thing? You know, you still have everything that matters, don't you? The church of Jesus Christ is guaranteed victory. And no matter what elements you battle spiritually, and no matter what Satan likes to throw at you, because I actually think a part of him enjoys it, the thing that matters most can't be taken. So my first question for you guys, just to get you involved here, because I didn't open with a verse, is the Church of Jesus Christ is guaranteed victory. Where do we read that in the Scriptures? It's a bold claim. It's a true one. Someone said, you know, because you say that at work, and you're used to hearing that around here. Have you guys ever said things at work, and you hear it around here all the time, and then you say it at work, and people are like, what does that mean? Like, all the time, right? So, oh, how would we back that statement up, that the church is guaranteed victory? Fire. I'll give you a hint. The most obvious one is in Matthew. Not obvious, but one that is in that context. All right, you older, wiser ones, you might have to get us started to get the ball rolling here. Don't be waiting. Kevin, are you going to give me the Matthew one? All right. Matthew chapter 16. I'll get the ball rolling. You got one? Braden? Oh. Gotcha. Yeah, good. Yeah, Matthew chapter 16, verse 18. I say to you that you are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overpower it. Isn't Jesus saying that the church wins? Absolutely. Where else? Yell it out.
Revelation 12.
Yep. Revelation chapter 12. Boy, really, to do it justice, you should read the chapter, but let's go down to verse 13, Revelation 12, 13. And when the dragon saw he was thrown down, the context of the chapter is the dragon is thrown down when Jesus ascends to heaven and applies the blood of the sacrifice. It says he is overcome by the blood of the Lamb. So Satan's final, you know, blow is, he's jumped off the cliff, right? And he's falling. And he hasn't hit rock bottom yet, but he's currently falling. Like that final, like his fate is sealed. Okay? So when the dragon saw he was thrown down to earth, he persecuted the woman, the church, who gave birth to the male child. And the two wings of the great eagle were given to the woman so that she could fly into the wilderness to her place where she was nourished for a time, times, and half a time from the presence of the serpent. So he's attacking the church, but then God comes to the aid of the church. The serpent poured water like a river out of his mouth after the woman so he might cause her to be swept away with the flood. But the earth, again, helped the woman. The earth opened up its mouth, drank up the river from which the dragon poured out of his mouth. So the dragon was enraged with the woman, went off and to make war with the rest of her children to keep the commandments of God and to hold to the testimony of Jesus. So, you know, you look up here a little earlier. Like in verse 7, there's war in heaven. Michael and his angels waging war with the dragon. The dragon and his angels wage war. They were not strong enough, and there was no longer a place found for them in heaven. And then Satan gets the boot at the blood of the Lamb. So not only has that, where that initial victory was won, but it looks like Satan can't stop the church, so he just goes off to pull as many individuals away from the church as possible. But he cannot stop the church because the gates of Hades cannot prevail against it. So, where else? Go ahead and seal it out. 1 Corinthians 15. That's a big chapter. Give me a verse, Mark. All right, good, good. Yeah. Yeah. Starting verse 55, 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 55. O death, where is your victory? O death, where is your sting? See, the Christian's the only one that can make that statement. Okay, the sting of death is sin. The power of sin is the law. But thanks be to God who gives us victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. Victory in the Lord Jesus Christ. Okay? Worst thing they can do is kill you, which just, you know, ushers in the greatest retirement package known to man. So, Larry. Yeah. And that goes right in line with Revelation 12, right? Because, okay, that's when that happened, right? Yeah. So, yeah. First John, you said 5:4, right? Yeah. I have another First John one written down, too. So let's look at that. 1 John 5:4, whatever is born of God overcomes the world. And this is the victory that has overcome the world, our faith. Again, the only statement, the Christian's the only one that can make that statement. If you go back a chapter here, I have 1 John 4:4 written down. Okay, he says, you are from God, little children, and have overcome them, because greater is he who is in you than he who is in the world. Okay, another spiritual guarantee. Mike, you had your hand up, or did we just take yours?
Well, I was thinking Psalm 145.
Okay. Trying to get her narrowed down there. Hey, I'm going to have you keep poking around, okay? Let's narrow that down, because I want this just to be a rapid-fire thing. Any others? Oh, well, yeah, really, the end of the chapter, right? Well, let's start in let's just read 5 and 6, I would say. Revelation 20, 5 and 6. The rest of the dead did not come to life until the 1,000 years were completed. This is the first resurrection. Blessed and holy is the one who has part in the first resurrection. Over these, the second death has no power, but they will be priests of God and of Christ and will reign with him for 1,000 years. So Christians are the priests of God. And because we've undergone our resurrection, okay, we are immune to the second death. There is no death for the Christian because we've been born of God. Okay, we are eternal beings, born of God, seated in the heavenly places. Those are spiritual guarantees. So, yeah. Oh, you guys get the point. I think we could probably find half a dozen to a dozen more if we wanted. Mike, did you get that narrowed down?
Verse 13.
Yeah. Woo. Psalm 145, verse 13, your kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and your dominion endures throughout all generations. A kingdom that cannot be stopped. So, yeah, so let's look here. Jesus said the kingdom of heaven is worth buying the whole field, right? So we got spiritual victory. I mean, man, that's a promise you got to take all the way to the bank. And it's an eternal one, okay? So now I want us to consider this in the light of the parable. I mean, Jesus said the kingdom is so valuable that it's worth buying the whole field, even if the field itself isn't necessarily like good ground, right? So you can get the treasure or the kingdom that's in it, right? And you have to go and sell all your possessions first in order to generate the money to go and to buy this field. So, you know, I always like to think of it in this way. You know, what if, let's even say financially, what if there was like an investment out there that like guaranteed a double on your return, right? Like, you know, I mean, guaranteed. Like, so for me, like, you know, I could make a $100 withdrawal out of the bank, you know, tomorrow, and I could invest that $100 and then I would get $200 back. Right? But because it's a guarantee, all of us would be thinking, how do I get all my money? Like, how can I get more than 100? Because 100 doubled to 200 will get you gas for a week. Right? But 1,000 doubled to 2,000 can get you groceries for a couple months. Right? 10,000 doubled to 20,000, that'll get you, what's that going to get you? A used car? Okay? You see what I'm saying? So, well, Unfortunately, that investment strategy doesn't exist, because if it did, then everybody would be investing in it. Okay, and but we actually have one. It's the spiritual guarantee. It's that if you'll invest everything into the church, it guaranteed victory. So now the question is, kind of where this class is supposed to theme out today, at least somewhat in my head, how much are you willing to throw in? Right? Because you're going to get a return. Galatians is clear. There's a law of the harvest. You reap what you sow. Okay? You sow the spirit, reap life and peace. Okay? Sow the flesh, destruction. So you can throw in $100. Most of us could probably find $100 in a day or two, and you're going to get return on that. So we want to follow the pattern of this spiritual guarantee. So the resurrected army of the Lord is assured of victory over the forces of evil. But, and here's a really cool but, just the way I see it. By the will and wisdom of the Lord, each Christian soldier decides what extent he wants to participate in the victory. Isn't that a really, and these are Jay's words, isn't that a really great way to word that? Each Christian, okay, we are guaranteed victory. Okay, you're a Christian, you remain faithful until death, the preservation of your soul, spiritual guarantee. Okay, it's just as much of a law like the law of gravity is, only it's a spiritual law, and it has to do with life and peace. Okay? And it's a guarantee. But each Christian gets to decide how much they're going to participate in the victory. Right? I can't think of like a specific example, but I remember hearing these stories all the time growing up as a sports fan. Okay? Malachi's a pretty big basketball fan. I don't know if you followed much of the NBA growing up, but if you think of one, just jump in here. But man, I think at least half a dozen times I've heard the story of the athlete who made it, right? You know, they always say, from the projects to the pros, right? Fought poverty, right? Fought all the obstacles, kept their grades up, got through college, first one in their family to go to college, played ball in college, okay, got drafted into the NBA, and they finally made it, right? And then dad, who's been gone for 18 years, all of a sudden comes out and they, you know, because the press has an interesting way of finding, you know, scrounging up a story, right? All of a sudden dad comes out of somewhere and he's like, yeah, that's my boy. It's like, dad, where you been for 18 years? Right? Malachi, you heard stories like that of people coming up into the pros? Yeah, it's, I don't want to say it's a common thing. It's like, I think like, you know, half a dozen times I've heard a story like that, you know, and it's like, well, now that the sun, you know, has arrived. Yeah, that's my boy. You know. Each Christian, you're guaranteed victory. And that is an amazing thing. But you get to decide how much you participate in the victory. Right? Because, and I like the way that that's worded, because a lot of times, maybe the way I usually think of it and word it is, you know, we've got this long rope, okay, and we're playing tug of war, and Satan and his minions are on the other side, and they're the darkness, right? And the church is on this side, and we're the light. And we have Jesus on our side, so we're going to win this game of tug of war, right? Like, we can't lose, because the church is going to win, but God still lets the rope tug, doesn't he? God still lets the deluding influence go through the world. God still, I mean, it's not like when you became a Christian, God put this magic bubble around you and said, now Satan can't tempt you. You can resist the temptation now, and you couldn't before, to the fullest extent of Christ, right? So don't get me wrong, there's a difference, but he still lets this thing finish out down here. Jesus' prayer in John 17, he's like, I'm praying for these. I'm not asking you to pull them out of the world. I'm just asking you to watch over them. So he still lets the tug of war go, right? So a lot of times the way I think about it and try to challenge myself, and I always try to challenge you guys because that's the position, okay, is how much do you want to be a part of that process? How much are you willing to sow to the kingdom? How much are you willing to seek Jesus' kingdom and his righteousness? I like the way that this is worded. How much do you want to invest in the victory? Okay, and I'm not saying this about you. It's just here. The follow-up thought is, are you just going to come creeping out of the woods in some backcountry town in Canada and be like, we won! Yeah, guys, good job! Where have you been? Now, I'm not saying that from my perspective, you know. The last will be first. So God gets to figure all that out, right? God gets to figure all that out. What I'm saying is there is a pesky parable of the talents, isn't there? And I don't know about you guys. You guys have heard my Geico Pinocchio joke, right? You know, they say, did you know you could save 10% or more on your car insurance? And then they say, no, I didn't know that. But did you know that Pinocchio wasn't a good motivational speaker? They're like, oh, why do you say that? And then they cut to a picture of Pinocchio leading a speaking seminar. It's like one of those, like, you know, you pay $100 and they teach you how to be better at goal setting or something, you know? And he goes, I look around this room and all I see is potential. And he goes, whoop. So Pinocchio is not a really good motivational speaker because he can't even fake it till he makes it, right? So I don't know. When I look around this room, I see a whole lot of talented people. A lot of super capable people who have a lot to offer the Lord, right? And so each one of us individually is going to answer to the Lord. And it's not just, you know, how many assemblies, you know, we've got an asterisk. I can never say that word. We've got an asterisk next to Wednesday nights because it's not in the New Testament. Wednesday nights are not in the New Testament, so we don't have to do that. Okay? You know, each one of us, okay, going to have to answer to the Lord individually. And he's going to ask you, he'll look at you, like, I gave you 4 talents. Okay? Did I get 8 in return? Right? So not so much just like how much are you willing to seek the kingdom. I like the way it's, how much do you want to be a part of the victory? Okay? Are you just going to come out 20 years later and be like, yeah, guys, good job, woo! The Christian can participate a little. He can throw himself in wholeheartedly into the battle, or he can even shrink back in shame. In any case, he is going to consciously or unconsciously decide the effort he puts forth. And from what I can tell, most of it is an unconscious choice. Because we are, our brains and our bodies are machines that are designed to survive. It is amazing what they can do, and we work really good on autopilot. And it's called the flesh. And it's what the Christian has to fight. Right? I'm going to skip that. I had the parable of the talents written down, but we already covered that. I want to get to some other things here. So in order to accomplish something, you must, to some degree, think about where you want to go and plan how you're going to get there. Okay? Now, I am just young enough to remember the trips we took to Hastings, Nebraska, and it was usually... Why did I put my coffee over here? I don't know. If not once a summer, every other year, we would drive down to Nebraska because that's where the family's from, right? And I still remember, okay, you had to figure out where you were going, and then you also had to figure out how you were going to get there. And that was usually printing out lots and lots of pages off of the internet on maps if you didn't have a really good roadmap. And so I remember sitting in there, you know, reading the map and like, where are we? Like, well, we just passed this town. Okay, we're right here. All right, so our next turn's coming up and it's right after here. You're trying to, okay, now you just plug it into your phone and it just tells you where you're going, right? So the illustration, you know, kind of has lost its power lately. But to any effect, if you want to accomplish something, you first got to figure out what that thing is. But then you do have to figure out how to get there. And sometimes what happens with people is, one, they're just no good at setting goals at all because they don't think past, like, what's in front of them. And those are people's natural personalities. It's not like, you know, if that's you, that's a bad thing. It's just some people are wired that way, right? And they're really good because they're present. And when you're talking to them, they're listening to you. It's a good thing, okay? But when it comes to goals, it kind of works against you, right? Because a lot, you know, first thing is sometimes you don't think past today. Right now, we don't want to worry about tomorrow, but we can plan our ways, right? And then we allow the Lord to direct the steps. Okay. The second thing that happens is we get so focused on the goal that we spend so much time thinking about what the right path that goal would look like instead of just getting in the car and just start driving. Okay? And that usually is what gets the people who do think with a goal-setting mindset, because they're so obsessed with the goal and getting it just right and all this that they actually just forget just to knuckle down and just start making some progress in the right direction.
That's a common thing that happens to businesses. And we read these case studies with work because we never want to be that way. But literally companies, they'll spend a year just analyzing and trying to figure out the perfect path and never do anything, called analysis paralysis. And then, yeah, I mean, millions of dollars are wasted, if not billions, basically because they're just way too much time planning and analyzing instead of actually doing.
Yeah, it's an excellent point and perfectly illustrates what I'm trying to communicate. So thank you, Larry. So, okay. I'm going over to Matthew chapter 5. You know, Jay said this one time. It's not necessarily in the notes, but it's something that stuck with me. I think I heard it at family camp. And he said, what a man is moving towards is a much more powerful long-term motivator than what he's running from. So I always really appreciated that because not only is it a more powerful motivator, are you interested in having a little more efficiency and productivity and power behind achieving your goals? No? Me? Just me? Okay. But then, how about long-term? Anybody ever start a goal and then quit a month later? Like, say, all of you every year, all the time? Yeah, January 1st is coming, right? Yeah. Okay. I'm really interested in having the power and the longevity to finish this fight faithfully. Okay. So, you know, Jay's point is what you're moving towards is a much more powerful and long-term motivator than what you're running from, right? So when I'm at the gym on the rower and I can't breathe and I don't have anything left in me, instead of running away from cardiovascular disease, I try to tell myself that I'm running towards a healthy future with my kids where I can still play basketball when I'm 50, right? But what you're moving towards is going to be a lot better long-term motivator than what you're running from. Show you an example of this in Matthew. Mike, you got a comment?
Yeah, it's vital that you have a strong picture and idea of what you're running toward, and that's real to you, though. Because oftentimes what happens is the realness of what we're running from, we allow that to define us.
Yep.
We have to have that picture of what we're running toward so solid in front of us that's our continual focus, because what's very real to us is what we're running from.
Yeah. Yep. And so takes a little more sitting down and talking it out with the wife or the husband or the mentor or the spiritual leader. It takes a little more time sitting down and thinking about this stuff and talking about it and balancing ideas. I mean, it takes time to shape what that thing is, because you're absolutely right. You do need a clear picture of what it is if you're going to start moving towards it. Because if you don't, we will default to what we're running from. So,
I was just thinking of 1 Corinthians 11 and how one of the easiest ways for me to see where I want to end up is to imitate other people that are already down the road from me, because then that makes it real in the... Okay, what's my next step of a good marriage, or how do I have godly kids?
Yeah. Well, that's an excellent point, Lorenzo. And you know, I'm still trying to fully wrap my head around this, but something that I personally really, really wrestle with is how can I help people grow spiritually? You know, how can I help them really, you know, put spiritual roots down and really take off for the Lord, particularly new Christians? And it's such a difficult thing to think about, because there isn't anything you can do. I mean, it has to come from within them. You know, you got a guy sitting to your left that knows what the world has to offer, okay? Someone shared the gospel with him, and he sees what Jesus has had to offer, and his foot's had he's had that pedal down to the metal since then, and he ain't looking back. You looking back, bro? No. Okay. Because when that light bulb goes off in your head, you don't have to beg people to show up for a Bible study. You don't have to beg people to battle the elements, to help somebody in need. Okay, it's got to go off on the inside. So the conclusion I arrived at other than being encouraging and you know, good solid preaching and the truth, is I do believe that faith is infectious. I do think it can be caught. You know, because I caught a lot of things of what hospitality looks like from the Fergusons. Right? And so that's just one example, but it's just seeing other people doing it. Okay? That's why we, you know, because Paul, in 1 Corinthians 11, Paul could have very easily said, imitate Christ. I mean, you guys got to think about why the things are written the way it's written. And we have that there to let us know we are to imitate faithful people. It's not the only place in the New Testament that that's actually taught. Okay, you are to seek out faithful people and then imitate them. Because that goes back to what Mike's saying. You know, you get a new Christian in here, let's get them here on a Wednesday night, and then I'll tell them they're seated in the heavenly places and they're supposed to seek the things above where Christ is seated. And they're going to walk away being like, got it. What does that look like? Well, sometimes it takes years and years of watching it play out in other people's lives who are faithful to really get a picture of what does this thing look like. Really appreciate the comment. So, Matthew chapter 5, verse 17, a good example of this. Jesus says, do not think I came to abolish the law or prophets. I did not come to abolish, but to fulfill. Why do you think Jesus said that? In the context of the Sermon on the Mount, why does Jesus say that? Jesus, yeah. Just yell it out. Okay. He says, do not think I came to abolish the law. So they were going to, he was very aware that his next comments were going to sound like he was speaking contrary to the law. Right? Because he goes, you have heard, you shall not commit adultery, but I say, you're not supposed to look at a woman with lust in your heart. So if you're sitting there, you're like, okay, are you changing this law thing or what? So he starts with, do not think I'm here to change the law. Okay, what Jesus did is he changed the way that we approach God, right? Instead of starting with the law and trying to make sure that we match the law on the outside, we just follow Jesus Christ in faith with hope and love and perseverance. And then the product of that will naturally fulfill the law. So Jesus is just changing our perspective of it. But where we're going, see, we're not running from the commandment anymore, are we? Like the nation of Israel. That's where your comment's spot on, Larry, because they're like, get us away from this thing, right? We're not running away from the commandment. We are going towards the throne in glory. That's why you seek Christ in his glory, and you'll be transformed into that glory. So that's what we're looking for. I'm going to speed things up here quickly. Philippians chapter 3. Just a couple quick examples of how faithful men considered tomorrow, considered their future, had aim and purpose, and then executed according to that aim and purpose. Philippians chapter 3, verse 13, brethren, I do not regard myself as already having laid hold of it, referring to his resurrection. But one thing I do, forgetting what lies behind and reaching forward to what lies ahead, I press on toward the goal for the prize of the upward call of God in Christ Jesus. Okay? Paul was a goal-oriented man. Okay? Very clear picture of where he was going. And guess what? Didn't look behind him, did he? He just kept moving forward. Kept moving forward. Luke chapter 13. A couple examples we could use for Jesus. I went with this one. Luke chapter 13, verse 31. Just at that time, some Pharisees approached, saying to him, go away, leave here, for Herod wants to kill you. Okay? And he said to them, go and tell the fox, behold, I cast out demons. It gets me every time. Behold, I cast out demons and perform cures today and tomorrow and the third day I reach my goal. Nevertheless, I must journey on today and tomorrow and the next day, for it cannot be that a prophet would perish outside of Jerusalem. Okay? So, Jesus had a goal. He knew where he was going. All right? He even had the prophetic Old Testament to tell him that his death was going to be in Jerusalem. So Guess I don't need to go anywhere. I don't have to run away from the fox, right? So, one, some closing comments here, and then I just want to leave you with something to chew on that's just kind of from me. And I'm a very goal-oriented person, very, very structured in that way. So this topic is exciting to me, but at the same time, I felt like it was worth one study instead of, you know, three or four. You guys get it. But I want to leave you with one thing that I've learned a lot over the years. I've learned over the years through the process of goal setting. Some comments here. We see that Paul was goal-oriented. We see that Jesus was goal-oriented. God himself is goal-oriented. I mean, how much stuff in that Old Testament is goal-oriented? Like, come prepare the kingdom, right? Come inherit the kingdom that was prepared for you before the foundation of the world. I mean, talking about beginning with the end in mind and having a goal, right? You know, I guess you could kind of go in a couple chapters there in Genesis, but in Genesis chapter 22, the wording is pretty good there, that God would bring the promise to Abraham's offspring, right? And now we know that that's the indwelling Holy Spirit, Christ in you, available to those through faith in Christ Jesus, Galatians says. So talk about having a goal, right? God is a goal-oriented God, okay? And so he put a lot of that stuff even in the pages of the Old Testament. So Christians then need to be goal setters, imitating the Father through the revealed character of his Son and through the positive example of men like Paul. In the church, we need to be goal setters together, to work together to achieve common and God-pleasing goals. Without goals, we drift, slowly sliding into routine. I very much agree with that. Going through the motions, with goals, we become a city set on a hill which cannot be hidden. And Jay's note says, you know, as a congregation, we need to work together to achieve a common God-pleasing goal. You know, I guess up to this point, I haven't seen the value in us, you know, wrapping up a Wednesday night with what's the goal of this church this year. And I don't think that that's necessarily like it wouldn't be a good thing. But here's what I know. The church is a flock. And Jesus is the shepherd. Right? So does the flock need cared for? Do we have the poor among us? Do people need, and those who aren't physically poor, like, could people use encouragement? Like, here's how I see it. We're called sheep. We're a flock. And we have a great shepherd. Okay? So, you want to talk about congregational goals? Take care of the flock. And then go find the ones that have wandered, that have strayed from God, because all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. So how about tending the needs of the ones who are in the pasture because of their faith in Christ Jesus, not because of the law? Isn't that cool way to think about it? We're this flock, and we're in the field, but there's no fence. Because we want to be here. Israel was a flock, but they had a fence. It was called the law. And if you tried to break the fence, then they would just break you. Okay? But people wander, okay? So you want to talk about goals. Each one of us individually just needs to consider that. Seek Jesus' kingdom and his righteousness. Seeking his kingdom is the church. Seeking his righteousness is putting on Christ, putting on his character, being peaceable, being gentle, looking for the things that don't stir up strife or strife and things like that, okay? And then, hey, there are... I mean, even Paul's teaching is, you think that there are other sheep that belong to God that aren't of this fold? Yeah. It's like, let's go get them. Get them in. Get them in. So I'll leave you with one last thought here. Goals, this is a quote from James Clear. And he said, goals are good for setting a direction, but systems are best for making progress. So because I'm a goal-oriented person, I was an insane systems person in business. So we get the report, the prime rib yield numbers are too low, it's costing us thousands a week. Okay, here's the new goal. Get it back into its appropriate percentage of around 85%. Okay, you've got a log in front of you, I guess that's what we called them, but you've got a loin of ribeye that's been prepared to become prime rib, in case you didn't know that. Prime rib is just ribeye, cooked really slowly and very yummy. And when you cut that thing, like, you know, 40% of it's fat, so you got to trim that fat off and throw it into the garbage, that's called loss, all right? 15% is an acceptable loss. So there's the goal, right? 15%. Acceptable loss. There's the goal. But it was the system that we put in place that got us to the goal. And you know what that system was? Every shift had a prime cutter. Because you wanted the same person cutting that meat every day. You didn't want Rain to get in there and cut what he thought was a 10 ounce. Then you didn't want John to turn around and cut what he thought was a 10 ounce. Because John's 10 ounce probably looks a little different than, you know, maybe what Kathy's 10 ounce looks like, right? And so you'd have the same person cutting. And then at the end of the day, you could see how much prime you sold and how much you had left, and then you calculate your loss. So then you'd put their score up there, you know. So, you know, Kathy would get 85%. And we would be really, really happy for her. Then the next day, you know, Will gets up there, he cuts, and he gets a 70%. You know, I'm like, okay, we need to have a talk here, you know. At the end of the week, the person with the highest prime cutting percentage got a gas card. So you got people who are having to drive to work every night. I mean, they fought tooth and nail for that gas card. I mean, that was their gas was covered for the week, right? And it was the system that set in place that got us to the goal. So I took a little extra time tonight to kind of stretch some of this out. And what I wanted to leave you with is, as somebody who's been an intensely goal-oriented person their entire life, I have learned to enjoy the process more than the actual goal itself. Okay, and I've explained this to you guys before. You know, I mean, you know, let's say Mike Dubb wakes up and decides he's gonna run a marathon, right? If his only goal is to run that marathon, it takes months to train. Then he runs the marathon. Then he achieves his goal, right? How long is he happy for? Like maybe a good 12 hours. And then what does tomorrow morning bring? What's the next goal? And if you're only goal-oriented, you actually only get to enjoy the process of being goal-oriented for about 12 hours out of about 2 months' worth of work. Because you're always, what's next, what's next, what's next? Okay? And it's the process of getting to your goal that's far more important than the goal itself. And so for me, I spent years being so consumed with setting good goals and achieving good goals, and I realized I didn't enjoy the process, you know? Like, whatever your goals are, you know? Goals are tough. You're trying to do something that's not natural. Because your natural position has put yourself in a place where you need to change something, right? So it's uncomfortable, and you don't enjoy the process. And then you finally achieve the goal, and you get to celebrate for 10 seconds because now we need a new goal. You see what I'm saying? You got to learn to enjoy the process, okay? We must learn to love the process, otherwise the original habits will take over. And look, this is going to hit. I hope this illustration works. It's my last comment tonight. But I hope it works. Because if you can identify with this illustration, it's going to really, really, I think for a few of you, open up your mind when it comes to where are you going and how are you going to get there. Every one of us is different. So I can't tell you set goals and do this and do that. You guys figure that out. But just understand the process matters. Because you got to enjoy what you're doing or you're going to stop doing it. Ever start a goal and then not finish it? It's because you didn't like it. Am I wrong? Every goal I've not finished is because I liked something else more. Like sitting on the couch. Guess I could go run that 2 miles today. Well, you know, I'm kind of feeling a little sore. This isn't what I want to do. You can't just, the goal itself is what I'm saying, will not push you. You've got to enjoy the process. So here's what I did. I can be a little matter of fact, a little like where I've had people in my life tell me, you just got to loosen up and have a little more fun. So we went to South Carolina. Mikkel's really going to appreciate this. So we went to South Carolina last year for this men's retreat. And although that wasn't the goal, it ended up being really good for me. Like I went to go speak and to encourage them. And then I left more encouraged. And I did something like jump in the ocean in December. And it was good for me. So I made a couple goals. One of my goals was to pet every dog I see, because I'm kind of a stiff around dogs. I don't naturally like dogs. They're hairy, you know, they leave a mess, they slobber everywhere. I had a dog and then it died. It was just a traumatic thing. I'm done. Okay. So I made a goal to pet dogs. Okay. If you bring them to school, I see them, you know, hey, what's your name? Oh, you're so cute, kind of, but you know. Because I like to do stuff like that just to push myself because this is the way I operate, right? So I'm the kind of person that will like check every alert as it comes in to make sure there's no ones or any notifications on my apps on my phone. And that's fine. Actually, a lot of you are like that. Okay? My wife is not like that. Okay? Mr. Burry is not like that. Okay? How many emails do you have piled up right now? 28,000. I know somebody who has more. Matthew Wilson. I think he's easily in the 40,000 range. Okay? Now, I don't necessarily get a lot of emails because I'm an organizational freak. I unsubscribe to 3 things a day. So I don't get as many. And I said, you know what I'm going to do, honey? I'm going to do something unheard of. I'm going to let my emails pile up. Because look, I'm not actually reading them. I'm just clicking on them so they mark as read. So it's been a year since that trip. I accumulated 5,000 emails. Okay, about 4,800. Okay, and I don't actually get a lot of emails. That's actually, I mean, it sounds like a big number, but it's actually not. Okay, so I was feeling pretty good about that. You know, yeah, look at me. I'm cool. You know, I'm laid back. I don't answer emails, you know. I am making fun of myself. But I had this picture happen today. What if I woke up and decided, okay, that was a good trial and it was good and it taught me to like let some things go, but now it's time to get rid of the emails. And now let's say there's not an erase all because I don't want all my emails erased. I need some of those, right? So the only way to get rid of them is to swipe, click delete, and then hit that obnoxious like, are you sure you want to delete? And then click yes. Right? So what, 10 seconds per email to delete it, right? So you wake up and we're over by about 4 minutes. Hang on here, because this is a really good picture for goals and then enjoying the process. Okay. It's time to get rid of the emails. So I get up in the morning, get myself a cup of coffee, get my Bible out, doing my Bible reading. Okay? And I get done, I get that phone out, and I delete. How much time can I devote to this in the morning before school? Like a good 5 minutes, right? So let's say I delete 30 emails. Okay, I'm going to get rid of them. How long did it take me to get 5,000? A year. Could I very easily get rid of 1,000 in a year? Or could I very easily get rid of 5,000 of them in a year? So delete. I deleted 30 of them. Okay, went to school, did my thing, came home, got 20 new ones that day. Oh. You guys starting to feel the illustration here? Anytime you try to make a step towards a goal? So how many did I actually gain? 10. So I wake up the next morning and I get up, make myself a cup of coffee, get my Bible out, put it in my lap, do my Bible room for the day, get down. I can devote about 5 minutes to this a day. And I go and I swipe and then I delete. I delete 30 emails that day. Go to school, do my thing, come home, get 20 new ones. Okay. Next morning, get up, I do really good. I delete 50 of them because I'm tired of only getting 10 ahead. So I delete 50 of them, take 10 minutes instead of 5 minutes, go do my thing, come home. Next day I wake up, I'm traveling, right? I'm in South Carolina all week. Okay, come home, how many emails did I delete all week? Do you do anything you normally do when you're traveling? Well, when I travel, I just eat Chick-fil-A morning, noon, and night, and that's about the only thing that gets accomplished when I'm traveling. Okay, so now I went all week without deleting emails, and at 20 new emails a day times 7 days, 140 new emails, now I'm behind 140 again. And I get up Monday morning, and I get my cup of coffee, and I get my Bible out, and put it out, and I'm going to get reading, and I got 5 minutes to devote to this thing, and I look, and I have more emails than when I started. But I've been deleting emails. But I'm actually worse off than I was before. So now I'm discouraged. So then I don't do it Monday. And that Monday was the difference between doing it Tuesday through Saturday. See, if I had just done it Monday and kept the habit going, can you guys see how this is an illustration? Doesn't that always happen to you? Set a goal. Get up, try to move towards it, and you do something to move towards it every day, and after a week, you feel like you're further away than when you started. That is why you quit, because you're only thinking about, I need to delete those 5,000 emails, and you're not actually thinking about, I enjoy this process. And when you set goals and when you do things, you need to learn how to enjoy the process. Because if you enjoy the process, you will do it even if you're traveling. And you will do it longer than 5 minutes a day. That makes sense? So as somebody who enjoys goals, they're great. You can't really go anywhere. I mean, if you jumped in the car and started driving without a destination, you'd end up somewhere, but it wouldn't be where you needed to be. You need a goal. But focus more on the process of getting there, figuring out how to understand and enjoy that process, and then just do a little thing. Look, I could delete 5,000 emails in a month if I just did a little bit every day. But the problem is you start, and then you quit, and then you get discouraged, and then you're done. So hopefully that was encouraging. We're a little bit over here. I really appreciate the extra time.